All right. I think we'll go ahead and get started. For those of you who may have heard it when you called in, we are recording the call, so it will be loaded to the website for people who aren't able to join at all or for people who are joining late. But this is Mitchell Warren again, the Executive Director of AVAC, and I'm delighted to welcome you all. It seems like 2014 is flying by already, but since it's still just February, I will say Happy New Year, in that this is the first webinar we're doing in 2014 as part of a series that we hope to put on during the course of the year to highlight a wide range of issues. And as you'll hear in the course of the call, well, we at AVAC have some ideas on what some of those call topics might be and what some of the advocacy priorities might be. We really want to hear from you both on this call and afterwards. What are the issues that are most interesting and important and relevant to all of you? And how can we facilitate that collaboratively? So we really are looking for your input into what other topics you think need to be addressed. A few quick housekeeping issues. As we said, the call is being recorded, and to keep the line clear, there is a global mute, so at least for the first part of this call. But there will be ample opportunity, we hope, for discussion and conversation. At any point during the call, you are welcome to, if you're on the web interface watching the slides, you can put questions or comments there. You can certainly email at any point to avac@avac.org. And when we are just wrapping up, you'll see the instructions to unmute and your lines, which, and I always forget this, *6, I believe, to unmute and ask questions and make comments, and then *7 to mute again. It's *7 to unmute your line, and then *6 again to mute. But again, we'll go through all of those instructions in a bit. The framework for the call, really, as you would have seen from the original call announcement, is to look at some of the priorities, at least, that we have identified as AVAC, and many of which were highlighted in the AVAC report, Research and Reality, that came out just before the end of the year. We've just come back from our annual advocacy partners meeting with our African partners just a couple of weeks ago, and many of the issues in this presentation were highlighted and refined and reality checked with partners on the ground, and you'll hear some of that on this call. And as we said, we really want to engage in the conversation with all of you on the line. I'm going to then present just for a little bit in terms of the report. I hope many of you have read it, but at the same time, I hope what we present here over the next few minutes is not redundant is actually useful and additive to see where we're coming from, and hopefully to engage to understand where you're coming from. So we'll do a bit of an overview, a snapshot on some key issues, and then, as we said, really want to focus on what's on your mind and what should we be doing together going forward in 2014. I do want to say, and for those of you who know AVAC and AVAC reports, we certainly take a fairly biomedically oriented approach, not exclusively, but certainly as an area of focus for AVAC's work. But none of the biomedical interventions are only biomedical, and we've all talked about this so often. There's so much about behavior and society and culture that influences as much or more than the technologies themselves. But even more so, as we stand here in February 2014, I think the events of the last few months and just this past week focused on Uganda and draconian laws being approved by parliaments and signed by presidents that have huge impacts, not just on the HIV epidemic, but on every possible issue of public health, of human rights. And many of us see that from a distance, and I think for a lot of us who work in this particular space, all of this came together just last week in the experience of Paul Semagoma, a dear friend and colleague to many of you on the line and to those of us at AVAC, who was with us in Harare at our partners forum, and as you will have heard in various emails and listservs last week, was actually not allowed to return initially to South Africa and was really threatened with imminent departure and forced return to Uganda, all happening in the very week that Museveni said that he would sign the anti-homosexuality bill. And it was really a remarkable global and particularly South African effort that in just a matter of days allowed Paul to stay and actually get the visa and the permit that he's due to stay in South Africa. So a great success, I think, there, and we're so grateful. But it really highlighted, I think, for all of us that no matter what happens with vaccines or microbicides or PrEP or voluntary medical male circumcision, that without basic human rights and dignity of all people, none of our work in advocacy and in policy and in biomedical science will really make that difference. And I think we all know that. We all say it. But certainly the last couple of weeks were a harsh reminder of that. And the news continues to unfold in Uganda. And I don't really want to happy to really engage in a conversation as we go through, but I just felt like anything we say about our advocacy issues with research and reality have to start with that reality. With that said, I do want to spend just a few minutes giving you a sense of where AVAC is coming from, where our heads have been in the report, and really do want to encourage questions, comments, again, email and via the chat function, and then when we open the lines in just a little bit. You will have seen this, hopefully, and I should say that the report and all of the graphics you'll see are available on the web at avac.org/report2013. You're welcome to download them, use them in any way that you see fit to really, if you find them useful. If you don't find them useful, if things are confusing or don't resonate with you, we want to hear that just as much as we want to hear that they may be useful. But our report this year was really trying to find this space in the middle of where research and reality coexist. Over the last couple of years, and again, for those who've read past AVAC reports, we have spent the last 3 years really looking at what we fondly call here the 3 Ds, looking at the development of new technology, the demonstration of the added value of emerging prevention and treatment options, and certainly the delivery, the scale-up to really have impact on the epidemic. And we've looked at that 3D, and again, it takes a slightly more detailed view to something that we all look at when we've been, particularly those of us who come from a research advocacy perspective, we've often focused on the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and increasingly as we see the promise of treatment as prevention, of voluntary medical male circumcision, of oral PrEP, the need to move beyond efficacy trials, and how do you go from efficacy trials to post-trial access to demonstration projects to actual delivery, and whether that takes months or sadly years and even decades, that really is the way we're looking at this research to rollout continuum, recognizing that even as we deliver what we have and demonstrate the added value, the clear development agenda and the things on the left-hand side of this slide of certainly ARV-based gels and rings, as well as non-ARV-based microbicides, vaccines, multipurpose technology, the emergence of long-acting injectable prevention, all spaces that we're watching, and we'll come back to this, I'm sure, as colleagues over not just the 2014 period, but over many, many years to come. And that really gives the long-term view, and for those of you who may have seen our quarterly PX Wire issue that came out just in the new year in January, we've tried to give a greater degree of specificity around 2014. And here you see spread out by quarters of the year some events either that we know will happen or at least we hope will happen, and then some advocacy goals. And again, we'll come back to this at the very end of these slides. You know, this is, you know, not an exhaustive list by any stretch, and certainly, as I said at the beginning, the need to engage with issues like anti-homosexuality legislation in Nigeria and in Uganda are new events that have much higher priority and urgent advocacy goals. But this was in January, in a sense of what we were looking at and some of the priorities with each of these goals going forward. And again, we'll come back to some of this detail in just a bit. But I did want to start at the very top one because I think it is one of the most timely pieces. And this is particularly true in the countries where PEPFAR is making major investments. And many of you will know that annually PEPFAR develops their country operating plans. And this is a process that is very much U.S. government-led and working in collaboration with national governments to develop these operating plans that really drive priorities and budgets and targets for implementation at the country level. Those have historically been developed by the U.S. government country teams in collaboration with their local partners, then sent to the PEPFAR OGAC office in D.C. where changes are made and they are either approved or, as they say, red-lighted. And this detail really comes from an amazing collaboration led by HealthGap, working in a number of countries in Africa with a number of partners here on the line, but to really look at how to engage in this process. And I think we've all learned a great deal in 2012, where in Uganda, HealthGap and partners really inserted civil society and pushed for the insertion of civil society in a very active and positive way that really actually got the COP, as it's called, altered in significant ways. And coming out of our partners forum in Africa just a couple of weeks ago, clearly the priority to engage with the COP's process, which is ongoing right now, is absolutely critical. And we really encourage you, if you're in countries where PEPFAR has major investments and you are not already engaged, please let us know. We will do our best working with in-country partners and with HealthGap to identify entry points for you if you're interested. And for those of you who are already engaged, we certainly want to help draw out those stories and those experiences, both good and bad, of civil society input. And I should also say, while this is focused right now, particularly because the COPs are due in February and March and being developed right now, that the possibility to influence Global Fund and very active civil society engagement there, particularly with their new funding model, is timely and a huge priority right now. This is just a quick snapshot visually of what that might look like from an advocate's guide that we developed with HealthGap and other partners last year. And again, it's available on the web, and anyone who is interested in engaging in the COPS process or has insights to help make these tools better, please let us know. We're looking to develop a similar advocate's guide to the Global Fund and its new funding model. The AVAC report this year, Research and Reality, was divided into two major sections. The first section focused on HIV prevention research, particularly focused on developing new additional methods for women. And we spent a lot of time, as many of you on the line have since the last year, looking particularly at the VOICE results, the trial looking at both topical and oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, grappling with what that trial tells us or what we think it tells us about participation in trials, about use of products, and a lot of the report, the first half of it, was focused on, as we described it, a field on the verge of change in this field of microbicide and HIV prevention for women research evolving. I think one of the things that's really important to note as we look, and people who've read our reports over the years will know that we've become somewhat slaves to timelines and looking at what's happening in prevention efficacy trials. And it's important to note that while 4 or 5 or 6 years ago there was a huge, robust pipeline of efficacy trials of microbicides, of PrEP, of vaccines, that right now we have 3 efficacy trials in biomedical HIV prevention, testing just 2 products. 1% tenofovir gel you see at the top of this slide in the FACS-001 trial that will have a result later this year, and then 2 trials studying the first vaginal ring, this one using dapivirine. And so really thinking about what those trials may and may not tell us in the next year or so is really going to be critical. And preparing, as I think we all need to always, preparing for success should those trials show efficacy, but just as much preparing for results that may not lead to a licensed product and an additional prevention option, and what are the implications for prevention research. And again, we'll come back to this timeline a lot, I think, together over the next several months. But in our final analysis, certainly, as we looked at this field on the verge of change, we identified a couple of important, 6 actually important issues as we looked at this. And that is that, the 2 trials, the 2 products in the 3 trials, tenofovir gel and dapivirine ring, are seen as really pivotal studies. But we want to be sure that as we look at those results, that we don't automatically abandon vaginal gels or other user-dependent methods for women and for men based on these trials alone, because we're learning so much from these trials, and we certainly want to look at how we course correct for both trial design and product development. But if these trials don't result in efficacious products that get licensed, we shouldn't automatically assume that that is the end. And we can certainly talk about that, and that's certainly not necessarily a consensus view, but certainly AVAC's view, and that we need to be preparing for additional efficacy trials. The second point really is investing in studies of why women and men, too, participate in research. I think so often coming out of VOICE and the FemPrep study, it's easy to say, and I think perhaps wrongly, to say that the result means that men and women will or won't use a product, and that the relationship between participant in the trial and product is the issue we're studying. And in fact, I think we've all come to learn that the interplay between a trial participant with the trial may have more to do than the trial participant and the product, and really trying to disentangle those issues so we don't necessarily throw out viable products because of what we think we learned in a trial. This third point, I think, is related, is really focusing a lot in the report about the differentiation between trial participants and end users. And again, one can look at the whole range of ARV-based prevention trials over the last 4 years of results and try to figure out who's in our trials, who's using the product, who's not using the product, and who might be the ultimate beneficiary of the product. And one of the hot topics that's happening in many research quarters, certainly, and we hope that civil society and advocacy will weigh in, is really disentangling efficacy and effectiveness, and is there an opportunity and maybe even a need to look at enrolling particularly high adherers in clinical trials to show product efficacy, and then look at how we deliver effectiveness within programmatic activities with the individuals who may be in greatest need of the product itself, and that the people in greatest need may not be the participants in a trial who are the greatest adherers, and really trying to look at that differently. Fourth, based on that issue of adherence, how do we measure different methods to improve adherence? And so many trials have talked about this. As many of you know, next week is the Retrovirus Conference, and there'll be even more conversations about adherence, how to improve it, both how to improve individual adherence, but also how to improve our ability to measure it within trials. And some terrific work going on. Some of you may have been at the Microbicide Trials Network meeting just a couple of days ago, where this has been discussed in greater detail. Fifth, planning for success, and certainly we've all talked about this over the years, but I'm not sure we have a lot of indication that we've done it particularly well, but planning for success for both the FACS-001 study and the ASPIRE and RING studies, so that if those trials do show efficacy, how do we very quickly move in to demonstrating impact, and are we learning lessons from the experience with oral PrEP, which I will remind people has shown demonstrated efficacy for a number of years, and yet we still see a very few number of demonstration projects to expand that result. And perhaps not surprisingly, coming from AVAC, the essential prioritization of informed civil society involvement throughout all of this, trial design, product development, and product rollout. And at the same time, as we look at those trials that are seeking to demonstrate efficacy today, this is a graphic again from the report that really looks at the growing pipeline of both various active agents. So most of our trials have looked at dapivirine to date, and tenofovir to date, and then the dapivirine ring. And you're seeing now a number of additional active products being studied, and perhaps even more importantly, different delivery systems. Obviously, we've seen the field do oral gel and ring, and you're seeing now a number of things further back in the pipeline, other rings, certainly other pills, but also looking at vaginal films, vaginal tablets, and a lot of excitement and interest in long-acting injectables. You'll see three of those in phase one, two of them antiretrovirals, one of them, the bottom there, the monoclonal antibody. So a robust pipeline, again, something that we hope to unpack together, and again, something that we think might be useful over the course of 2014 in a more detailed webinar to look at what that pipeline looks like. The second half of the report was divided into four what we described as research reality checks. That sought to look for some commonalities across issues that sometimes aren't necessarily in the same conversation. So this first reality check may be one of the few slides that you will see that includes both AIDS vaccines and hormonal contraceptives in a single slide. And again, there's a lot of important details in both of these areas. They're quite different in so many ways. But what we saw in our report as coming together in a single space is the need for the design and conduct of complex trials, and the complexities of trials, even if they're not, even if we hope for them to be simple trials, the complexities in designing and enrolling them. And again, we're not intending to go into a great deal of detail in either of these issues right now, although we definitely want to hear questions. We expect both of these will be subjects of follow-up calls. Just to show you two graphics, though, from the report, this one looking at the AIDS vaccine pipeline, and you'll see a very complex field that we've tried to synthesize into simplicity, and it may not work, but we're trying. This is basically showing you the major area of work in efficacy, the major part of this graphic in blue, the build-out from the RV144 trial, the Thai vaccine trial, again, with a result back in 2009. And here we are 5 years later, or 4.5 years later, really wondering what comes next. And there is talk of this over the last couple of years of the development of this pox protein public-private partnership that is accelerating a number of trials, some of them already in the field, smaller phase one studies looking in Thailand and South Africa, to begin to build to a series of efficacy trials that are meant to start by 2016. This is a timeline that continues to change and one that we continue to monitor and advocate that, you know, some things take longer than we would all like, but to make sure that there's clear, articulate, transparent conversations about when the trials might start and what might accelerate those trials, because that's a very long time frame from an initial result back in 2009. At the same time, at the bottom of the slide in green, you'll see the Adeno5 story, one that continues to evolve, including a publication that just came out last week that has shown us yet again very clearly that the Adeno5 vector is not going forward in the AIDS vaccine field. It is truly dead, as we said in the report. And needing to understand why that is and what it means for the future, and particularly then looking at what's on the left-hand side, the pipeline beyond, and again, much is happening in this vaccine strategy development space, and this is a very simplistic view of it, but you'll see other adenos there in the middle, as well as other approaches entirely to vaccine development. So a very complex field, a pipeline that is not as robust as I think anybody would like, but one that needs to be managed over time. And at the same time, again, a very different issue, but one that we put in the same reality check, is the issue of injectable contraceptives and HIV acquisition. And there have been a number of separate calls already about this topic, and we hope to have several more this year. This is a slide adapted to show you the range of data that is still quite inconclusive in terms of where injectable contraceptives are in terms of potential increased risk or decreased risk of HIV. And you'll see that the data is very mixed in these observational studies, none of which were designed to evaluate the interaction. And there'll be more data, I believe, coming out next week and more discussions next week at the Retrovirus Conference, so certainly stay tuned for that. But from the advocacy perspective, perhaps the most important message going forward is the need to better answer the question. How do we know and how should we learn the relationship between hormonal contraceptives, particularly Depo-Provera, and HIV acquisition? And many of you will know that there's been a lot of conversation about a randomized controlled trial that has been in the design phase for the last 2 years since a WHO meeting. It is called the ECHO trial. And there'll be some follow-up conversations about this in this webinar series, but it's we talk about it a fair bit in the report. AVAC believes very strongly that this trial should happen. That is not a unanimous decision by any stretch, but certainly as we looked at it as advocates, we think the trial needs to happen. We think it needs to be fully funded because we think this question needs to be answered while we still build out a much more robust contraceptive method mix. And again, we really want to engage in further conversation with all of you on this call and then ideally on a specific call just on this topic. Research Reality Check 2 really goes back to this issue of how do you move from results to impact. And again, a slide that looks at two different areas, oral pre-exposure prophylaxis and voluntary medical male circumcision, particularly with a view to surgical devices non-surgical devices for voluntary medical male circumcision. Two very different areas, but I think we're seeing two very different stories unfolding. and we've talked about some of these in different places, but this idea of how do you move from research to rollout and into demonstration projects. And as many of you will know, the first of the non-surgical devices, PrePex, was pre-qualified by WHO just last year, and already through terrific leadership from PEPFAR and through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you're seeing a really significant attempt to evaluate how this device fits in to VMMC programs. How might it increase demand, ease service delivery, and perhaps increase the scale-up of VMMC overall? 24 different evaluations, 22,500 participants, and a real strategic vision for how do you go from these evaluations into either scaling up the device or perhaps not in certain situations, but really trying to answer questions about how to use this in the real world. And that's a good story, and it's an important story. And I think for us as advocates, comparing it to oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, which has a range of efficacy trials that, as you all know on this call, have had very different results due largely to adherence issues, and yet with this potential, depending on which result, 70, 75, 90% benefit for those people who are able to adhere, and that is a challenge we know programmatically, and yet relatively very few demonstration projects outside of the United States. And again, there's a lot of background information on prepwatch.org, the website that we have that brings all the PrEP information together. But just to say, if you look at this slide, the Partners Demonstration Project, which grew out of the Partners PrEP study but is separate from it, is the only project right now in Africa that is looking at providing oral PrEP in a demonstration project to really try to help build programmatic understanding. The other projects listed here are either in design phase. The one in Brazil is funded and I believe is just starting now. And there are other projects that are being discussed, but you know, we now are 4 years after IPREX, actually 3 years after the Partners PrEP study, and yet so few opportunities to really understand if PrEP can add value in the way that we're seeing the question being asked, can non-surgical devices increase the scale-up of circumcision programs? So very different stories, and I think an advocacy space to watch for sure. Reality check three, and I'm going to go very quickly, and these slides will be available, and again, all the graphics are available for anyone who wants. An area that is somewhat new to AVAC, but I think something that really grew out of both interest in testing and diagnostics as well as in the treatment as prevention space coming out of the HPTN-052 trial, something that so many have said in presentations that the prevention benefit of treatment is not because people get on treatment, it's because they stay on treatment and are able to suppress viral load. So understanding and investing in viral suppression is an area that we're interested in really looking at from both the diagnostic perspective as well as the programmatic perspective in the course of the year and more ahead. Just very quickly, and again, many of you will know this, the WHO guidelines in July were important, first ever comprehensive guidelines for ARV treatment and prevention, and they actually increased, of course, the treatment gap between 2010 guidelines and 2013 guidelines. And this is the wonderful thing about guidelines. They're really important, but the day before the guidelines, there were 9.7 million people on treatment, and the day after the guidelines, there were 9.7 million people on treatment. Guidelines don't close that gap. They certainly help, and they're critically important. What do we do as advocates to ensure that we move beyond guidelines, get them implemented and adapted at country level, and begin? And related to that, one of the graphics from the report is actually a slide that we adapted from Médecins Sans Frontières and who I think have done amazing work in this space and bringing attention, I think, to providers and to advocates about the importance of viral load testing. But just a quick sense here of the different levels, the different benefits throughout the process from the individual level, most importantly, but to the donors and global health actors in terms of the importance of viral load testing. So again, a fairly new space for AVAC as advocates, but one that we think is an important one to grapple with. The fourth reality check may seem like an obvious one in so many ways, and the language is you know, again, pretty obvious. We need to ensure that models, programs, and funding stay on track to end AIDS. Possibly the easiest thing to say and one of the hardest things to do. And again, this is where we think combination prevention and the need for partnerships across a range of sectors really need to be aligned in a much more strategic way. It is interesting to think from a, you know, we talk about all the data that's been published across all of the different research activities from HPTN052 to PrEP over the last 4 years. One of, I think, the most important articles that we don't talk about enough came out around the same time as the 052 result, and that was the Towards an Investment Framework that UNAIDS led about how to realign our activities to the evidence. And I think coming up on the three-year anniversary of that, it's going to be very timely to think about, have we done better according to the investment framework? Have we truly aligned to those plans? And related to that is something you've seen in past AVAC documents late last year, the idea of a programmatic tipping point. It is certainly not a tipping point that means we are done by any stretch. It, and we certainly, I think, are seeing countries that if they do the right thing, they tip under this line and turn to blue. But it's just as easy to tip back if you take your foot off the pedal, to use the driving analogy, from either prevention or from treatment, you can tip back. And certainly this is a tool that we're hoping to work with partners at the country level as an advocacy tool and as a monitoring tool to really look at can you tip and stay tipped and continue to go below one and well below one, and how do we drive the global numbers below one as well. And again, happy to come back to the tipping point. And I should say that one of the things we really hope out of this call is to have you help identify issues that you want experts, and I am an expert in none of this, whether it's about the tipping point, whether it's about viral load, whether it's about hormonal contraception or long-acting injectable prevention, what are the topics that you most want to see unpacked in future webinars in this series? So finally, I just want to end, and again, it's back to, for us, the three Ds: deliver what we have for immediate impact, demonstrate the added benefit of new options as they become available, and never taking our eye off the long-term prize, which is to truly end the epidemic. And again, back to the investment framework, doing all we have today with evidence, according to the investment framework, can take us from 2.5 million new infections to 1 million new infections, still 1 million too many. How do we get below 1 million? And that's where the long-term research and development agenda needs to remain robust and aggressive. And most of all, whether your favorite topic is circumcision or viral load or vaccines, again, easy to say, must be thinking in terms of combination prevention. No silver bullets or simple solutions. We all wish there were, but we're not finding them yet. So that is really, I know, a lot of different issues, each barely scratching the surface, but really wanted to give our partners a sense of where AVAC is looking in 2014, what we see as priorities, what we see as advocacy needs. But we really want to hear from you in the next half hour. What are the issues uppermost on your mind? What needs action at the global level and at the country level? And what's on the front burner? What should be on the front burner at the country level? And really want to open that up. And again, the chat function on the web, avac@avac.org, you can right now be able to hit *7 to unmute your line. I would ask that you introduce yourself, *6 to mute your line. We may not get to answers, or at least not all of the answers in this call. We really want to begin to surface the issues, at least, that need a lot more work and collaboration amongst us all. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop and just put this back up in terms of our attempt to try to look at 2014 and the timeline and what some of the events are or should be and what the advocacy goals might be, and really want to hear from all of you of what that might look like. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop just happily take any questions. And again, just to say, *7 to unmute, *6 to mute again.
Hi, this is Kate. Can you hear me?
I can. Hello, Kate. That's Kate Hankins, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, Kate Hankins. I'm actually in Trinidad, not in Amsterdam this week. But I wanted to ask whether there's much advocacy going on to get the price of PrEP down. Because it strikes me that the focus is right now on using a device in a sense, is detracting from some of the countries' work to scale up. And I think it's, at this point, we've had at least one, maybe two articles pointing out that it's not cost-effective at the price it's currently at. So is there a role for advocacy to push for a more reasonable price?
Absolutely, Kate. It's a great question, and for those on the line, I promise you I didn't ask Kate to ask that, but I'm so glad she did. For us, it's one of the most critical issues, and you know, you well know from your time at UNAIDS and elsewhere that there's been a lot of talk about the devices over the years and the promise of them, and I think many of us have a lot of questions about the role that they will play. Are they truly the game changer? Is this the one thing that's going to shift circumcision? And I think the answer is probably not. But price is critical. We've been, frankly, alarmed that census prequalification, which was in May, so 10 months ago, we've been told from a lot of different folks, including people at the company that make PrePex, that there have been intense price negotiations and maybe even a price that is to be announced. But it's not been announced publicly, and if anyone's on the line, either from CERC MedTech or from the Global Fund or from PEPFAR, please tell us, because at $20 a device, this can't possibly be the game changer. If it's much less, will it be the game changer? I don't know, but certainly price is going to be critical, and I think it is a huge advocacy need right now, and really would love for people to weigh in on this.
Thanks, Mitchell.
Other questions or comments? And I should say, just apropos of the devices, there, you know, PrePex is not the only one. It is the one that is pre-qualified to date. There is a resource on the AVAC website looking at PrePex and the number of other devices that we hope can be updated sometime soon with actual prices, because that is going to be critical.
Hi, Mitchell. This is Mark Barone from Engender Health.
Hey, Mark. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll just make one additional comment in relation to the circumcision devices related to the Shang Ring, which you know, we are continuing to work with, and Mr. Shang has agreed to an initial price of $9 per device, so it seems like it will likely be less than PrePex. It's not pre-qualified yet, but this week, the WHO team is visiting Mr. Shang's facilities for the follow-up visit in the final step for that pre-qualification process. So we're hoping to hear some good news about the results of that visit soon, and that the device will also be pre-qualified in the relatively near future.
That is, thank you so much, Mark, and so glad you're on. And I think, again, it relates beautifully to what Kate said. And from an advocate's perspective, to be able to say a $9 device that's not yet pre-qualified, how does that fit into this discourse of a pre-qualified device that at least publicly is $20? So that's great, and really look forward to seeing where that goes going forward.
Great. Thanks.
Other questions? And it can be about anything.
Mitchell, we have a couple of questions in the chat box. You want to take a look there?
Oh, I'm an idiot. I didn't look there. So sorry. My chat feature was above. So Anna Forbes, Anna, you're probably on the line. Do you want me to ask your question, or would you like to answer? Or ask it, or answer it?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Anna. Sorry.
I was typing while thinking, which is sometimes a problem. I saw that in the report, in AVAC's report, under the discussion of the ECHO trial, that the reason it hasn't gone forward to date is because it's not fully funded. And I saw in the report that you were suggesting that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation consider fully funding the trial if other step up. My understanding is that they've offered to fund half of the cost of the trial and are waiting for other donors to step up.
Yeah.
If you had any sense as to what advocates can do to help for this trial move forward, since it is to find out whether or not DMPA has any effect on women's HIV risk, and what you thought of was a possible time frame in which a decision would be made as to whether this trial was going to go forward, and if so, how?
A great set of questions, Anna. I'm so glad you asked them. And this is one of the priority issues that we are scheduling one of the next webinars on. Just to say, as far as I understand the state of play, the Gates Foundation has played a very active role with the team developing the ECHO protocol and had committed, as they said, up to half the cost of the trial, and had provided some initial support, as we heard in Zimbabwe a couple of weeks ago, to do some of the initial protocol development and beginning to scope the different sites. So they've certainly been committed to this, and I think the issue has been the desire to see other funders, both in reproductive health and family planning funders as well as HIV funders, to really step up and co-fund that trial. And you know, I think for me, the main advocate point is that I don't think, my sense is that donors are not yet hearing that this is a priority for anyone, it seems. And I think that if you, Anna, but particularly anyone else on the line, and particularly other organizations working in sexual and reproductive health, if this is a priority, if this is an issue that concerns you, then we need to amplify our collective voices, because I think the lack of donor commitment and the fact that no one is stepping up and saying that lack of commitment is worrisome means that there's a sense that people don't care about answering this question. And that may be a terrible, it's an assumption, and it may not be why people aren't being active and loud about this issue. But if people think this issue matters, and we at ABAC think it absolutely does, then we need to really ratchet up our voices, because it's not just whether the trial happens or not. It's what might the trial look like. And again, as you will have seen in the ABAC report, the early plans were for a four-arm trial looking at randomizing participants to one of two injectables, DMPA and NetN, to an implant and to a copper IUD. And again, I am not going to pretend to be the expert in the trial, and I'm not related to the trial at all. But, you know, the idea was to be able to look not just at DEPO, but to look at all four of these methods to understand if any increased risk, because it's important to recognize that a lot of the data that was in the slide I showed about DMPA or DEPO Provera, it's not that it means the other products have a beautiful, clean slate and are fine. It means we just don't know, because they've been much less used, particularly in high HIV prevalence settings. So what we wouldn't want is to say, take DEPO out of the system, a method that is so widely used, and replace it with a method of unknown potential risk with respect to HIV. So it's really important that this be seen, not just does DEPO increase risk, but what of the contraceptive method mix is most appropriate in high HIV settings. And again, we talk a lot about method mix. We obviously need to expand it, but as we hear so often, it's not as if individual women in a clinic in many countries actually have a choice of this very rich method mix that's been developed in contraceptive research. Many women go into clinics with one or two choices at most. So we do need to expand the mix, but we need to be sure to expand it with methods that we have good understanding of the interaction with HIV. So a long-winded answer, I think the most important question is to really get engaged on this issue. We are just now developing a fact sheet that's briefer, obviously, than the report, that kind of lays out what the current debates are about the trial. I suspect decisions will get made in the coming months. And if anyone wants to engage actively in this issue, you can send an email directly to me, Mitchell@AVAC.org, or to Emily Bass at Emily@AVAC.org. We would love to have more people joining the effort, whether you agree with the trial or not, or what you think the trial should look like, to at least engage in the issue. We would love it. So please do be in touch directly. Actually, I'm delighted. There's a question in the chat box about contraceptives for young women in Zimbabwe from Definite Nahamo, who is a brand new AVAC 2014 advocacy fellow based at Pangea Health in Zimbabwe. And she's asking a lot about this method mix and a question about introducing more methods. And I think that it's one of the reasons, and it's a great question, Def, it's one of the reasons that AVAC's very supportive of this trial, because introducing some of these methods, an IUD, an implant, some of these methods have not been widely used in a number of the settings where this research is likely to be conducted, which is East and Southern Africa. So the trial may actually be a good way to help understand the product introduction and the needs with providers to ensure that women in Zimbabwe, where Death's asking about, but elsewhere too, begin to understand the needs of introducing these additional methods. So, you know, it really is a critical issue, both in terms of answering a question related to HIV, but also to look at truly expanding the method mix. So I hope that answers it a bit, Death, and delighted that you're on the line. There were two other quick questions in the chat function. One is a simple one, and that is that will the slides be available on the AVAC website? They will. They'll be at avac.org/meetingreports. There'll be both a recording of this call as well as the slides, which you're welcome to download. And I'll say, just to mention again, that each of the individual slides from the report, the graphics there, are available at avac.org/report2013. They're available both as JPEGs as well as PDFs so that you can easily make slides, hopefully. If you have any questions or need more, please let us know. And actually, a great friend and colleague in the U.S., Jeffrey Pope, has asked a great question. What should advocate groups and individuals focus on regarding the AIDS conference in 2014? And it's a really important question, and I want to just say two quick things. And one, to broaden that out, just so I don't forget, as you'll have seen on the timeline of 2014, there are actually two important conferences that are on the calendar that we're watching very closely. One is the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne that Jeffrey asked about, that I'll mention in just a second. It's in July. But also, there is the brand new HIV Research for Prevention Conference, the so-called R4P Conference. And it's the first ever of its kind. It is building on previous annual AIDS vaccine conferences and the biennial microbicide conference. It's merging them and building on them to be a comprehensive biomedical HIV prevention research conference that will also include all the critically important issues of advocacy, policy, social and behavioral science. And a lot of that will depend on all of you engaging in the conference. And the website just went live this week, and abstracts are open, scholarships applications are open right now. I encourage everybody to apply. And we are very happy if people have suggestions for sessions or abstracts to work with you to really help anyone make sure that we get the right kinds of issues there across the entire prevention research landscape. But I'm actually ignoring Jeffrey's question, which was really about Melbourne in 2014. And I have to say, and I'd welcome anyone else's input, it's a challenging one. We at AVAC have typically used the large International AIDS Conference to do a range of activities. The distance to Melbourne and the cost is great. And I think a lot of us are hearing that there'll be less and less engagement there than in some of the past conferences, which is unfortunate. I think that in terms of the priorities, I think one of the things to advocate for is a logistic one, which is in the absence of a huge physical presence, to be sure that the conference is much more modernized to ensure engagement for all of us who might not be in Melbourne to engage with the conference in real time. And I think that's an advocacy point that we could all be making to the International AIDS Society today. In addition, I think that you know, there likely will be a lot of conversation less about science and more about money, whether it's Global Fund or PEPFAR. So I think that there's some big issues that are going to be on the table for Melbourne, and I think it's important for all of us to be looking at that and trying to find ways to input, particularly given that many of us will be doing it from a distance. I'm sure there are other things. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, please, go ahead.
Hi, Mitchell?
Yes.
Hi, this is Adika Dusi from Prepex. I'm the marketing and communication manager, and I've heard
your
conversation. I would like to respond to Kate's question. Well, as for now, as you know, we are still in negotiations with Global Fund, and we've been asked to refrain from mentioning any details about the contract negotiations. However, we believe that we'll be able to share with you the agreed purchase price with Global Fund for Prepex very soon. So if you could please wait a little bit longer, and we hope to share some good news with you. Of course, it's everyone's need to contact, finally have an agreed upon price. Other than that, we're soon going to be more active, and Prepex is going to be scaled up in Uganda and Rwanda very soon, also in Zimbabwe, and South Africa is already starting, and we will be happy to cooperate with you, with AVAC, and with any other organization. If anyone is online and listening, we will be very happy to work on more activities, more social activities, to raise awareness to HIV prevention within the public society. Of course, it's very important to us to make sure that everyone is aware of the fact that male circumcision only provides up to 70% reducing risk. And we would really like to make sure that everyone's aware of the importance of still using condoms. So if anyone is interested, I would be happy to share my email later or address in person. And basically, I even get to see you in Melbourne in 2014. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, and really appreciate that. And, clearly a great advocacy opportunity to both hear directly from you and to be sure to stay tuned and to be pushing for rapid comments from both Global Fund and from you when a price is public. So we definitely look forward to that soon.
I will make sure to publicize it. Don't worry. I will send you all an initial email.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining.
You're welcome. Bye-bye, everyone.
Other questions or comments on any of the issues, or issues, again, wanting to come back to what are issues that we didn't cover that should be uppermost on any of our collective minds? And perhaps two additional things that would be wonderful to hear from people on the line. One, are there particular issues that we touched on here or maybe glossed over that you think would be increasingly useful? I'm gathering from the comments that the issue of the ECHO trial and hormonal contraception, to better answer Anna's question, would be very timely, and we will do that with urgency. Certainly something on the non-surgical devices, and not just on Prepex, but as Mark said about Shangri-La. But are there other issues that you'd love to see subsequent webinars in this Research and Reality series cover? So I'd love to hear input there. And then also, just going back to the very beginning, in terms of being on the front burner, are there things that those of you on the line are doing or think should be done in the current couple of days and weeks related to the situation in Uganda and the legislation there? So I'd love to hear any comments on those two issues. Or not. I realize it is challenging on calls like this. And it is *7 to unmute your line. All right, we are, I know, coming up to the top of the hour, and I realize people are inevitably going to have to jump off. Was that someone on the line?
Michelle, looks like there's one more question in the chat box.
From Mark Hubbard's on the line. Mark, do you want to go ahead and ask that?
Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning. This is Daryl Dixon calling out of Detroit by way of the United States. My question to you, Mitch, is what is the process of getting involved to have AVAC in prevention of HIV in terms of having AVAC involved in the research process?
Oh, thanks, Daryl. A great question. AVAC's now just coming up on 20 years old and has been involved in AIDS vaccine research from the advocacy perspective from its beginning, and over the last 7 years has been working across a, the wider range of biomedical prevention. And I guess the easiest thing to say is we follow the research. And again, for those, some of you may not be that familiar with ABAC, we don't conduct research. We are not a funder of research. We're a small advocacy group who monitors and tracks research. So we're always keen to hear new issues and ideas and encourage people to bring forward any research they're involved with or ideas they have, and would love to hear more. And you can certainly just be in touch with me directly, Daryl, after the call. Great.
This is Mark. Should I jump in now?
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I would just say we haven't talked about today, but I think very important in the context of conversations in the MSM community are post-HPTN-052 trials looking at the impact of viral load on transmission risk in more diverse populations that include men who have sex with men and trans folk, and attempt to capture the risk of anal sex as well. So that's something I'd like to hear about if those move along far enough to get an update or discuss the issues around.
No, that's a really great question and a great point, Mark, that is important because, of course, all the data from 052, or almost all of it, comes from couples in heterosexual relationships. So really important to understand its implications and application elsewhere. The one other thing, and that you didn't actually say in this, but maybe an important issue for a lot of us to think about is, HPTN-052 continues, as Mike Cohen, the principal investigator, is fond of saying, it still is looking at the question of durability. So that trial's continuing, but it will be finishing soon. And I think one of the issues that we didn't talk about at all in the report or in the webinar is, as many of these trials are completing, both the regular phases as well as the open label extensions, like, IPREX has completed its open label. CAPRISA-008 will soon complete its open label. HPTN-052 will soon actually end. What happens after a trial for trial participants and trial sites? So that may be an issue that part of your question just triggered in my mind some thoughts there. And I do want to say just another wonderful comment just came in from another one of our incredible new 2014 fellows, Tricia Njoki from Kenya, and she's basically talking about prevention strategies for women and the need to focus on this more. And I think that it's absolutely true, and we certainly spend a fair bit of time in the AVAC report really grappling with this and understanding. I think at the end of the day, and in one of the sessions we had at the Partners Forum in Harare, what do women want, and what do men want, and how can research and researchers and advocates understand and address it differently and better? So it is a core priority, I think, for all of us working at AVAC in directly and in our partnerships, that we need to focus on that more. And not just about what gets researched, but what actually gets developed and how it gets developed is a huge, huge priority for 2014, and I dare say for a number of years after that. I know a few people have already been dropping off from the beeps, and it is just past the top of the hour. Really want to thank all of you for joining the call, some of you very late in your days in Africa and Asia, but so, so grateful for all of you to be on the call. If you missed any part of it, for those of you who joined late, the recording and the slides will be up on the web very soon. We also will be sending around the email a request. Please do let us know if there are issues that we didn't cover or that you don't agree with, or that you want to know more about. Please let us know. We really do want the Research and Reality series to be your series, not ours. So let us know what issues percolate that keep you up at night, and we will do our utmost to bring in expertise from those different areas and doing that. So you can send emails to avac@avac.org. We will compile those, and please stay tuned on the Advocates Network for the series as it unfolds for more information. And again, a lot of these other materials are available on Report 2013. If you didn't get the email about this call series from the Advocates Network directly, if it was forwarded to you, you can sign up to get those updates directly at Advocates Network at the avac.org website. So I really want to thank you all. For those of you who asked questions, they were terrific. And for those of you who haven't had time yet, please do email us. And we'd love to have more input into what advocate agenda should look like in 2014 and beyond. So thank you all. Have wonderful evenings, afternoons, mornings, or what's left of them. And we look forward to collaborating in 2014 and beyond. All the very best.
Thank you. Please stand by.